Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. I'm Brian Dunn.
And I'm Robert Hookman Jr.
And we're going to talk about the success of Spillers number 5 tonight, Robert.
Spillers number 5, which just wrapped up a short time ago, like an hour ago.
Yeah.
With 150 some odd people.
150 people for a short fiction reading in Phoenix.
No, 150 some odd people.
150 some odd people.
Gotta be more.
I always kind of wonder where they come from and who they are. Like, I want to know them all and shake their hands and go, what are you doing here?
We should shake their hands. Every last one of them. No.
We should.
They're great. We had people approach us after the show and they loved all the stories. They loved the story of the person we have right now as a guest on the podcast, and it is Catherine Hill.
Man, did they love that story.
Oh, my gosh. They totally did. She read her short story, Madam Mamanita, and it was a hit. Welcome to the podcast, Catherine.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Leah Newsome, you are classmates with her. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, she was singing your praises for sure after that. And so I asked her, I said, did you think that unassuming Catherine Hill had that kind of story in her? And she said, no.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah.
Yeah, she said something like, you know, I was in class with Catherine before I came here. And now I don't want to go back to class.
it's going to be tough. Yeah.
This is what she said. It's just a shockingly good story.
You
capture the voice and the time period and just the rhythm of that music so incredibly well. And honestly, the second I read that story the first time, I forwarded it to Brian and said, I think you're going to like this. Brian's a big jazz fan.
So. Huge jazz fan. Yeah. Yeah. And we should say that it's a piece about Jelly Roll Morton. It's a letter that he wrote. And it's the response back from the woman who he is no longer with. And So tell us, how did you come about this premise, and what was it like for you writing? You mentioned on stage that it's not your normal style.
Yeah,
so
definitely not.
So what is your normal style, and how did it feel to really like break out of that for this story?
Sure. Well, I started writing the piece because I was taking a class with Tara Eisen, who read at Spillers 4.
Yes, she
and
did.
And she was great at Spillers 4. And she's also a great teacher. And she was teaching a research-based fiction class. And I don't really do research-based fiction unless I have questions while I'm writing, you know. And so she had given us this prompt, and it was just a packet of articles. And we had to include 5 facts from the articles. And they were so disparate, like poodles and heart conditions and ghosts in Arizona and things like that.
Wow, okay.
And so I chose the ghosts from Arizona article because I saw there was a 2 tiny little paragraph section about the Cuban Queen Bordello in Jerome, Arizona. And I had just been there with my family, and I was like, oh I don't remember
to the
this
Bordello
place.
Or no, to Jerome?
To Jerome. I didn't remember seeing
the
Bordello, but yeah, it is still there. Yeah, you can Google image search it.
You can?
Yeah.
You can bring your
Cuban
family
Cuban Queen
to
Bordello.
Is it a family-friendly Bordello at this point?
Okay, good.
Arizona is so good at these weird tourist locations.
Yeah. Someone call them traps.
And so it was just this little 2 paragraph thing, and it said, oh, this woman, Bessie Johnson, lived here and ran this bordello. She was the first wife of Jelly Roll Morton, the famous jazz pianist, and like his godmother, Eulalie, was she practiced voodoo and came and like did stuff in the back kitchen of the bordello, and like that's the end. And
wow.
It's like, No, there's got to be more to this.
Yeah.
I also really like jazz, and I played jazz when I was younger. And
you did?
Yeah, I was in a jazz band when I was in high school.
And
I knew
cool.
Jelly Roll Morton, and I was like,
yeah,
I've
absolutely.
Never heard of this, you know, of this
wow.
secret
That is
history.
A pretty loaded paragraph to just, you know,
it,
leave it
at
that.
It was literally 100 words, and I was like, no, you can't do this to me with like 100
right.
words.
Don't
so
leave
I
me hanging, yeah.
fell down some research rabbit holes, and I was just fascinated by this woman. She doesn't show up in like regular sources on Jelly Roll Morton. You have to really dig. I ended up finding a PhD student's like dissertation on Jelly Roll Morton's genealogy, and that's how I found out more information about her. So
are you saying you think the Jelly Roll Morton estate is trying to silence this woman?
I mean, they have an amazing story. They of course separate in 1924, like what happens in the story,
mm-hmm.
and then they are separate for the next 30 years until Jelly Roll Morton is hit by a car and is going to die, and like calls for Bessie Johnson to come back, and she like visits him and stays with him at the end of his life until he passes away. Like,
oh my gosh.
Like, when I read that, I didn't know what to do with it. Like,
that's
oh
a
gosh.
Big turnaround from the tone she took in this, in your story. And
huge.
I realize it's fiction, but
yeah. Well, at the time, you know, she still loves him maybe, but also hates his guts.
Yeah, anger is the prevailing emotion.
She doesn't just hate him. She is stone cold.
Yeah, she's pretty brutal.
Yeah, totally.
There are a couple lines in that, like the one about how she runs the only house where nobody fucks to one of his records,
right.
Which I think is just, oh man, it's so harsh. You read it on stage. I've read this line multiple times now, but you read it on stage and there was just that pause right afterwards. And I literally turned around and said, man, that's cold.
It's true.
Yeah, I mean, she's a tough customer. She runs a bordello house. She's a woman in the West. She's a black woman in the West. You've got to be tough to hack that out. So
absolutely. So how were you able to channel that anger and that emotion? What did you tap into to arrive at that?
Yeah. What's going on with you?
Because you're such a nice person, seemingly.
No, everybody always has concerns about me after these kinds of things.
What?
No, I like once wrote a story for class and it was a prose poem. It was for a prose poem class, and it was about this town of people that like eats people's hands, and it was this horrific story where people like eat their hands and screens are then attached, and like one of my classmates just looked at me, she's like, Catherine, your shoes have flowers on them and you're like so kind, like what's wrong with you? Like how could you possibly?
Why are you writing
this
stuff?
This is a constant question.
There's a line in this story, I even commented on it about after your story, after your reading, where I said it's the line I would pay a dollar for a record of your footsteps out of town. This line knocks me out every single time I hear it.
It's
brutal and it's vicious and I just have such a hard time believing it came out of you. You're so pleasant and so nice.
I mean, I think it's kind of a funny line.
Where
too,
does this
a
come
dollar?
From?
A dollar? You pay a dollar? Like, great.
Well,
you
know? Maybe at the time a dollar
then,
was a lot.
Yeah,
then,
I'm assuming a dollar,
then,
yeah.
It's a lot, right?
Well, but yeah.
Now it's like,
yeah, exactly. I was thinking that through, and yeah, I mean, a dollar's a pretty substantial amount for a record of footsteps.
Right.
She
right.
really wanted that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just stone cold, and I love it, and I it's just, it's amazing that you're able to bring that power out in to create such vicious lines.
Well, thank you. I promise I'm not vicious.
No, you don't strike us as vicious.
I don't believe you're vicious for a second.
No,
so that's what keeps tripping us up is like, where is this coming from? Like, where did you develop this craft? How do you
dark childhood secrets? Oh, I don't really have any.
How do you go from 16-year-old Catherine Hill to woman who busts out words like that?
Nobody knows those things. Right? No, I wrote a lot of really bad poetry when I was a kid. I wanted to be a poet. Didn't pan out. Yeah, can't do that poet thing.
Can't do the poet
thing?
There's
a certain thing poets do in poems that I can't do. And somebody finally told me, like, why don't you try fiction?
Oh, they
nudge,
did.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Like,
right,
get
right.
out of the poetry class. Like, you don't belong here.
Oh, my gosh.
Thank you for telling me. You know?
Right.
But your writing is so incredibly poetic, it seems like.
It is, though.
Think,
it's true.
Yeah,
you're
I think
not
I have a natural
writer.
Ear for it. And so that's why I thought I wanted to be a poet. But, of course, I can't.
Well, I think you're doing just fine with the
poetic fiction
with what you're
I'll
doing.
Take.
There you go.
Prose
there
poems.
You go.
Maybe.
So you read prose for ASU's Hayden's Ferry Review. Do you like reading prose for that?
It's a really cool experience.
Is
because, it? Yeah, it actually really is. And at first when I signed up for it, I was like, oh yeah, like this is something I'll do. But it actually really helps to read other people's work that they're submitting because you kind of get to see where you stand a little bit in the pecking order, right?
Oh,
like,
right, right.
Like you can kind of see like, oh yeah, I write things like this or, oh, you know, I see this is a trend now. I shouldn't write anything about this because lit mags are getting, you know, bombarded with 18 million stories that take place here or with this. And like
right.
all of a sudden the other week there were a whole bunch of stories that referenced Pepsi, like six stories in a row all talking about Pepsi. And I was like, note to self, like, don't talk about Pepsi.
Wow.
We not noticed
weird.
This too.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, not the Pepsi thing. But,
no, not the Pepsi
certain
thing.
But we noticed, yeah.
Certain words.
Well,
yeah.
There's a certain month where we'll get three or four stories that all seem to be about the same topic.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, no more of these.
No
after
more.
After this event, no more of these.
Yeah.
Do we want to say what the topic was most recently?
So there was the dying parent theme.
A lot of dying parents.
There are a lot of dead parents in our inbox.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's because it's an easy emotion, right? Grief. And you can tell a lot of flashbacks with it. You know?
You can.
But grief is more complicated than just like, I lost a parent. It's always more than that. So if it doesn't quite go into that, it's a lost cause,
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's also a really tough story to tell because everyone, like if it's at all autobiographical and fictionalized, then it's really hard to detach from it, I think, and find the compelling story.
Yeah. I've also had to read.
It's not compelling just because it happened.
Sure. Yeah. That I've faced that with creative nonfiction submissions for Hayden's Fairy 2s. You read them and, you know, people have insane, horrific, tragic, traumatic lives, and you're like, I'm gonna reject this because it's not well written, but please, I like, dear author, like, I'm not rejecting you. Like, you as a person, you know, I'm not rejecting your life story. I'm just rejecting the way this is written, and it's a hard thing to kind of.
Yeah, yeah. You kind of want to give him a hug.
You do. You're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, you're okay.
A lot of them.
Yeah,
you're okay.
A lot
I'm
of
okay. We're okay.
We're okay. I just don't like your writing.
Yeah.
So there's that classic adage that in order to be a writer, you have to both write a lot and read a lot. I absolutely think that that's true. And what you were just saying, like, I feel like Brian and I can both relate to that as well. Like, we read a lot of fiction that other people submit to us. And I feel like it, not just through that, but also through interviewing writers like we're doing right now.
Sure.
I actually feel like I have developed a lot as a writer as a result of reading everybody else's work and by talking to writers. It's such a fascinating thing, just sort of immersing yourself in the careful readership and the careful listening
of
absolutely. All that. Just so
seeing what you can steal from other people.
Oh,
you
know? Wow. You know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I've done that.
I like how they did that. Perfect. I will take that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that'll fit nicely here.
Exactly. No, exactly.
Great artists steal. That's what they say.
That is what they say.
That is what they say.
So I read that you're a huge Flannery O'Connor fan.
I recently read Mystery and Manners for the first time.
You did.
Which is her collection, well, a collection of lectures / craft essays on fiction craft, and it's wonderful.
Is it wonderful?
It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes.
What is it you like about?
I liked it a lot. I'm teaching one of the essays I'm teaching fiction this semester, and so I'm going to be using one of the essays which talks about like what is a story and why do we write stories and kind of in a more lofty sense, because she also just flat out tells you like, I don't know how to tell you how to write a story, which is great because it's Flannery O'Connor and she's supposed to be telling you how to write a story, and she's like, there's no way to write a story, like you just eventually do it. And I like her a lot too because she talks about very regional things, or she also talks about spirituality in a way that I think is very interesting that we don't talk about a lot anymore. And I liked her kind of take on incorporating faith or backgrounds in faith, or like what it means to come from a certain place, or and how that affects your fiction, or what people expect from your fiction, or what you expect, or who are you accountable to, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Depending on where you come from or what you believe. I just find that interesting. People don't write craft essays or give lectures on those kinds of things, I feel. So
yeah,
fascinating book.
Yeah, what a great essay to use for your class.
Yeah. Oh, I'm very excited. I hope my students are excited. You know, sometimes you show them things you love and then they hate it.
Oh no. Does that happen?
Yes. I gave them an excerpt last semester of The Passion by Jeanette Winterson, which is one of my all-time favorite books. Just don't ever give students things you love because they will say like, I don't get it and this is dumb and I think she doesn't know what she's doing. This is Jeanette Winterson. Like, she knows what she's doing, guys.
Yeah, she's fully aware of what she's doing.
She's fully aware. So it's just things like that.
The class will attack your heroes.
So, gosh, I'm hoping they don't, like, destroy heart. Flannery O'Connor.
Oh, my gosh. I should hope not.
If they do that.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
I love that she would just come out and say, I don't know how to tell you how to write a story.
No, right?
Because, I mean, I've thought about this before. It's such a bizarre concept that we spend. I mean, basically, like, storytelling is pretty well buried in our DNA, you know, like
definitely.
As human beings, we have a natural tendency to want to tell stories and to know how to tell stories. But for some reason, those of us who decide to do it for a living or to attempt to do it for a living, we'll then spend 90 years trying to figure out how to do this thing that was already in our DNA.
Yeah. That's true.
And so it's refreshing to hear somebody say, you know what? I have no idea.
Yeah. I mean, it's as much talent as it is craft, quote unquote, as it is, you know, just effort constantly to just keep doing it, right? I think at some point in one of her essays, she's like, at some point, I just I now have the expertise to write stories, and that's how I do it. I'm an expert. I'm like, wow, bold, assertive. Kudos to you, Flannery. Like, that's awesome, you know? So
Wow, that's fantastic.
Man. So the tell us about the Conyngham Review Fiction Prize. You were the winner of the 2016 Innovative Fiction Prize from the Conyngham Review. What was the innovative aspect?
Yes.
Tell us how this works.
So the piece I wrote was called The Mother, and it is a very sad and depressing story. First person about a woman who just found out she's pregnant, and it's her mental interior psychology dealing with this fact. And so it deals with how she thinks her husband will react and thinking about her own mother and her sister. And she thinks all of these things while also watching a woman across the street interact with her family. And that's what it is in a nutshell. But I guess what's innovative about it, is that maybe the paragraphs are a little strangely formatted. I mean, they're not tabbed at all, and they each have a space between them. It's not maybe formatted like a standard story. And she herself, the character, sees the world in a very oddly poetic way and starts describing, she has a lot of body insecurity issues because her mother was anorexic, and so she's not, but she grew up with that. And so she starts becoming very nervous about the physical aspects of how your body changes during pregnancy and how she's going to gain weight and her husband won't love her anymore and like blah, blah, blah. And so she ends up, the end of the story kind of ends with this climactic, massive paragraph where she is turning her body and her eventual child's body and the woman across the street and her daughters into food. And she's, you know, talking about how they have udon noodles for veins and, you know, like, just like all of their body parts are different foods. And which sounds kind of lame when I say it out loud, but it works in the story.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of interesting cycles of imagery that happen in her head based on like the experiences she's had. And I guess that's what's innovative. But I'm not really sure why it's innovative, apparently Lindsay sounds Hunter thinks it's innovative. So
it's innovative?
Lindsay Hunter
does.
I'm
sure Lindsay Hunter knows innovation. She sees innovation.
Yeah. I mean, before I submitted to the prize, I researched her and read some of her work. And I was like, well, her work seems similar to some of my work. She will probably like my story. And she did.
And she did. Wow. Very smart of you to do the research.
You got to research first, right? You don't submit to a lit mag that you don't know what they publish, because they probably will just reject your story if it doesn't go along with what they want, right?
It's not going to fit in their audience.
Same kind of thing
that's
with contests.
I wonder if that's why people have such difficulty applying to Spillers, because we're kind of all over the place. So.
Yeah, maybe we're not giving them enough, go on.
We're too broad, I think.
Okay.
No,
you don't think so?
No, definitely not.
All right. So you're writing a novel right now.
Yes.
Okay, so you posted a picture of all of your novel notes from your notebook.
You went through my Twitter feed.
Yeah. We totally went through your Twitter feed. Yeah.
This is what Brian does.
I like to dig up these things.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so looked like things were kind of in a state of semi-disarray.
They still are.
They still
months
are.
Months later.
Okay. Months later.
Yes. I started working on this novel project in January with one of my other MFA friends. Our New Year's resolution was novels.
That's
such a dumb idea. It's a great idea. And so, no, it is. It's a really great idea.
Yeah.
So we've been kind of working together, and, you know, she'll come over to my apartment and I'll go over to hers and we'll, you know, share notes on what we're doing and the struggles of the novel writing life, because it's so different from writing a short story. And I don't think either of us fully realized that until we started writing novels, and you're like, oh my gosh, it's a totally different animal.
Yeah.
It's completely different. So yeah, I've been working on it since January.
And so how far have you gotten? Is it going to come to fruition within the calendar year?
Well, I turned some of the first three or four chapters in for workshop last semester, and they were well received. So that's good. But now I'm moving into like the meat of the novel.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. I just have so many ideas. It's such a big story. And, you know, I'm used to telling very small stories, or I write a lot of flash fiction, and a novel is just so many words. It's just such a long time to expand a story over. It's like, oh my gosh, I just read a quote the other day that was like, I don't remember who said it, but writing a novel is like building a bridge. Like you're just throwing a bridge across a river, like hoping the end of the bridge lands on the other side. Like you're just shooting all of these words out into your computer and like hoping that it lands. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's such a weird analogy and it's perfect. So,
well, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
Paul Mosier was talking about this once to me, and he talked about how when you're writing a novel, you don't necessarily need to know. Like he kind of operates on faith a lot.
Yeah.
He doesn't necessarily need to know where it's going or where it's going to end or anything like that. Like he only wants to be able to see enough to kind of get around the next bend. And then once he's there, you can kind of see the next bend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just one sentence and after the next.
Yeah.
And
my strategy has been writing the islands. I don't remember who came up with that either, but I learned it from Matt Bell, and who read at Spillers 4 as well. And writing the islands.
We
is
knew
the
that.
Idea.
Oh. Yeah,
well,
he was great.
Maybe they don't.
good point. She's plugging Spillers number 4. I love it.
Spillers number 4. So writing the islands is, you know, like the major events that you want to have happen, and you write those first, and then you just write all the connective tissue between it.
Oh.
To get you to where you know you eventually want to be.
Oh, that's interesting.
The problem is you have to know where you eventually want to be, which is
in animation they call those keyframes.
Oh.
When somebody's creating an animated show or any kind of animation, really, you create like the various states that things are going to be in, and then you create everything that happens between.
Very cool.
So that makes a lot of sense.
It's an analogous adventure, I guess.
Yeah, I would say so.
I don't know where I was going with that, really. But just
I don't know, but I think we're going to end on that note, Robert. I think we have to let Catherine go here.
Just interesting and useless facts I have in my head.
I love them. Keep them coming. So, Catherine, thank you so much for taking part in Spillers number 5. We loved hearing your story, and thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Catherine.